I'm Dorothy Wickenden, and on today's Politics and More podcast, the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, talks with Sarah Koenig, the co-creator and host of the podcast Serial. In 2014, Serial helped make podcasting a phenomenon in the mainstream media. It recently began its second season, telling the story of Bo Bergdahl, the soldier who walked away from his base in Afghanistan in 2009 and was captured by the Taliban.
Now, for many years, I've been reporting from Russia, living there in the late 80s and early 90s as a reporter for the Washington Post, and returning for reporting trips ever since. In the 90s, when big Boris Yeltsin was in power, I was hanging out with some friends, and I met a funny, smart young woman in the New York Times bureau named Sarah Koenig. She wasn't long out of school, but it was very, very clear that she had everything it takes to become a first-class reporter. But who knew what kind? Sarah Koenig became the co-creator and the host of Serial. I think you know the rest. It was downloaded about a gazillion times and changed radio and podcasting completely. Now Serial is into its second season with a story about a young man named Bo Bergdahl, who wanders off his base in Afghanistan and ends up captured by the Taliban. He was a prisoner for 5 years until the U.S. government finally worked out a prisoner exchange deal. Joining me is Sarah Koenig. So, Sarah, I don't think we've talked in years. I met you in Moscow in maybe the 92, 93 or something like that. Am I right?
Yeah, a little later, I believe it would have been 96-ish.
Ah, and you work for the New York Times.
I did. I was a peon.
And now we're talking some years later, and you are the host of the most remarkable podcast. And I want to talk first about what came in between.
Okay.
You were a crime reporter for a conventional newspaper for a while, and what you made your mark on last year with the first season of Serial was a crime story. And I'm wondering how you see the way you would do a crime piece in a newspaper and the way you set about thinking about things when you came all these years later to Serial.
I mean, I feel like it's not like I was some great court reporter or anything. I think, though, maybe if I try to parse it now, I was always really suckered by both sides. I'd be covering a trial and I'd be like, well, that sounds reasonable, you know, and then like the defense would give out and I'd be like, what? Right. He didn't. That's right. I believed everyone. Like there's shades of truth in here that are a lot subtler than we generally acknowledge in this system. And that was always the part that was interesting to me.
Were you sick of newspapers? Was there a fed up moment?
No. I mean, I feel like, yes, I was fed up, but I was a bad fit. I mean, the stuff that was interesting to me was never quite what was interesting to my editors.
Give me an example of that.
I just remember there was a time I had been covering this thing where the courthouse itself, the building, was basically sort of infested is the wrong word when you're talking about pigeons, but like there were just a ton of pigeons everywhere. And what would happen is, like, they would die and just, like, their carcasses would be rotting on the little balconies outside people's windows. Like, it was disgusting. And people were starting to, like, people were worried that it was, like, a health problem. People were getting, like, bronchial problems and getting weird infections. And I remember that they had a press conference in front of the courthouse. And there was a poster. Like, someone had, like, pinned up a poster on the podium. And it said, cancer, cancer, cancer. And I just found that really funny. Just, like, the theater of how government works and how press conferences are, just like the inherent phoniness of them and the inherent theater of it. And like, I just remember really enjoying all of that and that kind of coming out in the story and just like all of it, cut, slash, slash, like take it out, which is proper, right? Like that nobody cares. I don't know. The truth is I heard This American Life on the radio one day and was just like, what is that? I had never heard anything about like that. And I was like, that's what I want to do. That is what I want to do.
And so you went to work at This American Life for a while and started a side project called Serial.
Yeah.
And the first season is about a high school murder mystery. It's a huge hit. And now the second season is about this kid who walks off his army post in Afghanistan. You and your colleagues strangely warned that people probably aren't going to like season two as much as they did season one, which struck me as kind of funny. Why did you say that?
It's not that they, well, I guess it is that they wouldn't like it. I think that there was, you know, and I weirdly did not understand this going into season one. Wow, people really like a murder story. I didn't understand the true crime genre.
Did something about true crime bother you, the confluence of people die and it becomes a form of kind of entertainment and news at the same time?
I mean, it bothers me now. I don't think I thought about it that much before I did the Syed case.
It bothers you now?
Yeah.
What you actually went and did?
No, because I don't think I did that. I see others doing it, and I like to criticize them, but I don't think I did that.
So in 1965, The New Yorker published Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, mm-hmm. which was a mass murder. Two people broke right. into a house and killed an entire family. Mm-hmm. Truman Capote came to William Shawn, the editor at that time, and said, and he kind of lied. He said, I want to write a piece about the way this murder affected the town. And Shawn thought this was a great idea. And then, of course, Truman Capote went out and he wrote the greatest true crime book ever written, and it kind of invented what's now known as the nonfiction novel. And mm-hmm. one of the secrets of New Yorker history is that William Shawn hated In Cold Blood.
Really?
It embarrassed him. Yeah, it made him worry. People are running to the newsstands to hear about this thing that I'm finding deeply unsettling.
It was so untoward.
You're saying that you didn't do what Capote did in some way?
Well, I mean, I think maybe we're talking apples and oranges. I think that there's an industry of true crime, and then there's also just like the whole, you know, franchise of like CSI, SVU, Law and Order, all of that stuff, right? Which is drama, which is a different thing. But, you know, I think sort of taken together, there is this whole industry of crime stories, murder stories, and mostly they are making things more fake than they are. And I don't think that In Cold Blood does that. I think mm-hmm. the brilliance of what he did, right, is he makes you kind of almost empathize with these killers. I mean, he makes you, or at the very least, he forces you to try to understand them. And like, that's the huge difference that I see.
And that's what you want.
That's what I want, yes.
You want us to empathize with the subject of the first one and now Bo Bergdahl. But
try to understand. At least don't judge before you've tried to understand. That's what I want.
When you're looking for a second story, you're looking for a second season,
mm-hmm.
what were you looking for? What did you want? And then how did the Bo Bergdahl story happen?
So we didn't know what we want. We really were like, we were really floundering around for a while. So the Bergdahl story came because Mark Bowles' production company, Page One, so Hugo Lindgren, who's, I don't remember his title exactly, I think he's the president of Page One or something, he knew Julie Snyder, my partner. And so he sort of came to her and was like, hey, we have this tape. Do you think we could do something with it?
So this is totally fascinating. Mark Bowles, I think it's fair to say that he was a journalist, turned to the movie business, mm-hmm. and he's famous for Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
And Zero Dark Thirty.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes and he approaches Bo Bergdahl and gets access to him and interviews him for 25 hours. What was the arrangement there? You know, because in the movie business, when you do that and you get someone's access and life rights, you very normally you pay for them. Was that the case in this case?
So he, you know, like obviously Bo had agreed to talk to him and Bo knew that these conversations were for research for this movie. I feel like I probably shouldn't talk about whatever Mark's arrangement is with Bo just because it's not my business.
But isn't it your business? I mean,
I know it. I just don't know that I should be talking to you about it. I mean, what I can say is, like, we've certainly not paid Bo any money. And as far as I know, there's not been any money exchanged between Page One and Bo. But I would want to totally fact check that. That okay. I can say. That I can
now,
say. Yeah,
and
yeah.
And what's your relationship with Bo Bergdahl?
So my relationship is very arm's length. It's completely mediated through Mark.
So that's a challenge I've got to think. What challenge does that present? How do you deal with it?
So I really worried about that in the beginning. I was like, how am I even going to find my way into this material if I can't interview him on the record myself and all of that?
Can you interview him at all? Did you talk to him off the record or for background? Or it's just do you have the ability to pick up the phone and talk to Bergdahl?
I do not have the ability to pick up the phone and talk to Bergdahl.
And no way communicate with him?
It's a little... what I'll say is what I have access to are the recordings that Mark Bohl has made with Bo.
And it's 25 hours of it, and the first thing you do is do what? You just listen straight through?
No, well, the first thing I do is read straight through, read the transcripts. Yeah.
And when you read them the first time, what was the impression that you had? You thought, oh, my God, he's so brilliant, he's an idiot, he's so fast. What do you take away?
My thing was I'd never seen someone talk about this topic in a way that felt like intimate like this, and frankly, just some of the facts of it are on their face extraordinary. So he's also describing something that like almost no one has experienced before. The other thing that struck me is he's a really unusual person. The way he thinks is not the usual way. And I felt like he was trying really hard to explain himself in a way that I find rare.
How do you mean?
He's really trying to explain how things felt and how he put pieces of information together in his head and then the decisions he made based on that information, how he's like
and
processing
stuff. And sometimes
it's
shocking. At one point, I was listening, I guess it was in episode one, and he says he wants to be Jason Bourne somehow. He wants to, quote, prove to the world that I was the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to prove to myself, I was trying to prove to the world, anybody who used to know me, that I was capable of, you know, being that person.
Like a super soldier, you mean?
Yeah, I was capable of being what I appeared to be.
Why not just wait and see if you got the opportunity to prove that, like, on a mission, you know? Because you hadn't even been there that long. Like, why not wait?
No, I haven't been there very long.
Why not wait a couple months and see if you get a chance to prove yourself in a, you know, some kind of tactical engagement?
Because it was a combination of situations. The situation that I was in was an extremely bad situation. I saw things falling apart as far as my command was.
Right.
Was concerned. So it wasn't that I just decided, hey, I'm going to do this to prove that I could do it. I was trying to find a solution to the problem at hand.
Right.
And I tied into it this idea.
Right.
You know, kind of like, two birds with one stone.
I was just going to say two birds with one stone.
I mean, this is also what's cool about it is, you know, at the time, Bo doesn't know that he's talking to a podcast audience. Bo's just talking to Mark for research on a movie. It's not a journalistic endeavor in quite the same way that I was doing with Adnan, where, like, I'm approaching him as a reporter saying, like, I would
like
to
do this. But
just
to be clear, Bergdahl was okay with the switching over of the purpose of those tapes.
Oh, of course. Like, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be doing the podcast if he weren't. Like, yes, of course. And in a way, it's kind of freeing, you know, for me, where I don't have to worry about that relationship all the time. It's stressful to manage that relationship over, like, a year and a half or however long I was doing it with Adnan.
Over time, in the same way that a writer develops a voice in print that's not precisely him or her, you've done the same on radio. How conscious is it, and how did you come to it?
So I don't know. I think the best way I can explain it is when I started to write season one, the first episode came pretty easily, but the second episode we did like edit after edit after edit. It was just taking like weeks. And my colleagues were just like, it's not working. It's not good. Finally, Julie Snyder, who's my partner, she was just like, I need to know what you make of all this. You, Sarah Koenig, make of all this. Otherwise, I don't care. I don't know why you're telling me all this stuff about like high school kids. I don't care. You need to make me care. And I was like, oh. And I was quite uncomfortable with that initially. But then I realized like, oh, that's the thing that's going to make you listen to the stuff I think is important.
And that's what makes the show, right? I mean, to some degree, it's Sarah Koenig's voice and also the peeling back of the artifice of old-fashioned journalism, of saying, here's the way this sausage is done. Sarah, is your voice on the radio completely written out?
Yes. And yes, it is so scripted. Everything is scripted.
So then what are you trying to achieve in the Sarah Koenig that you're presenting? No writer is herself or himself on the page exactly the way they are out in the cold, messy life. So what's the difference?
What's the difference? I mean, yeah, I'm probably more cheerful on the I don't know. You know, like, I feel like that's so personal. I feel like you're asking me to, like, you know, undress or something.
We're not in the same room. People should know
that's true. I know. God, phew. I think that I am trying to convey that you can trust me because I've done my homework. I know that sounds really boring, but for me to get away with having a little fun in it, like making a joke every once in a while, which I just think, like, sometimes you just need it when the material is dark. Like, it's just, it helps you get through.
Like the moment of, here's me calling the Taliban.
Sure, right? Like, I mean, I'm just, it's funny to me. Like, I would like to be able to make jokes, but I think, like, you have to earn them in the sense that, like, it can't just be self-indulgence all the time. You have to kind of, you have to telegraph that, like, I'm going to be interrogating this story in the same way you, the listener, are interrogating it at home. I'm standing in for the listener all the time. I feel like that's what I'm trying to do.
So clearly newspapers in this country, not just provincial newspapers, but newspapers in general, are having a horrendous time.
Yeah.
And it's not just because of the squinching down of advertising and all. It occurs to me that some of it might have to do with style. And along comes this different way of telling a story, and it appeals particularly to younger people. What do you glean from? What lessons do you take away? What do you think you've brought to the table that wasn't there that caused such a furor and such a center of interest?
I mean, nothing that I did was new. Exactly. You know, in other words, like, narrative journalism isn't new. Serialized storytelling is not new. Having a voice in your stories is not new. But I think that there was something about the bringing together of all of these things, and especially the kind of week-to-week thing where you had to wait a week in between. And I think what happened is people found that they were enjoying, they were interacting with it in their brains in the same way that they're interacting with, like, escapist entertainment. So, like, House of Cards or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they sort of were like, wait, it's not, but it's real. It's journalism. This is journalism. And I'm interacting with journalism in the same way that I interact with escapist entertainment. So, of course, that, like, so that raises, like, a question, right? Like, is that okay?
And how do you answer that?
And, yeah, I mean, I think it is okay as long as I am sticking to journalistic principles, and as long as we're sticking to the truth, you know, I mean, however you define that, but I think we're okay. I mean, you want people to listen to your story, like we all do, right? Like, there's
You want the story itself to innately matter, to have some.
You want
larger...
it to matter, yeah, of course. And but like a lot of people listening helps make things matter. I mean, no matter how beautiful it is, if like 10 people read it, it wasn't going to matter.
We'll be listening. And Sarah, it is great to connect with you again after so long.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
That was New Yorker editor David Remnick talking with Sarah Koenig.